What I want to do at this point, I want to go back and pick up just on a couple little conversations we had. Well, let me just ask first. How many of you know? You can see in the back some other repertoire from this. How many of you know a number of songs from this stream? Let me ask what your context is.
A church, yeah. Evangelical Free.
Evangelical Free.
RCA, Farm Church in there.
Uh-huh. They have a nice new hymnal as well.
Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Yeah. Someone back there? Yeah.
Anglican.
Uh-huh.
United Methodist.
Mm-hmm. So, pretty widespread of people, in those traditions it's starting to appear. In other traditions, you have to go look for it in some other places. So, I think there's a lot of possibility, and you'll need a copyright license, and CCLI won't do it. You'll have to have onelicense.net for this particular one. But I think you could easily make it worth your while financially to have that particular. And it's good for Tazay, Iona, and lots of places. Give us a little description of what you were talking about.
Well, I was saying that I think a lot of the times it's not so much the song or the hymn or whatever that's the issue, it's the soundscape. And last summer, I'm one of the organists, but we have another organist, and she had a hip replacement, so I had been doing a lot of stuff with our praise band. And I had a woman come up to me and ask me when we were going to start singing the songs we all knew again. And we've been doing some new songs. And so I said, well, just hang in and see how it goes. The very next week, I again was using the band, but this time I had added a part for handbells to play with the band. The same woman came up to me afterwards and said, I think we can learn these new songs. All I did was add the handbells.
Interesting.
Church musicians are a devious group. We have to be, or we wouldn't have survived. We don't have the power. We have considerable influence. This is scary for some people. But we have to be, in the best sense, sly every once in a while. But the great thing is that creativity often happens in those kind of situations. And so when we get too concerned, whether it's Bach or Mozart, or Hillsong. If we get too concerned about stylistic purity, then we're losing the point here just a bit. Now, in my former life, I used to be a countertenor. Now I'm just more counter and not so much high. But I love Baroque music, and there are certain things one does that you can move toward that direction. But we don't know exactly how it sounded. So why get so fussy? Music has to be made by real people in some place. Now, again, I'm not going to take the Hallelujah chorus at a deadly slow tempo either. So there are certain things one can do. At the same thing, when I found the global song, my goal is not to reproduce the exact soundscape in Des Moines, Iowa, where I grew up. I think an overfocus on that can be a kind of tokenism. My goal is to bring that song alive as a witness from someplace else in that place. Now, I can move in that direction and adjust the soundscape, but they really aren't ready for a five-part West African drum ensemble, I can tell you right now, in Des Moines, Iowa, in the church where I grew up. It would be overwhelming. But I can give a taste of it. And what I have found when I've been in various situations in this country, by at least moving it in the direction without and pacing myself, is I rarely run into, say, a Nigerian or someone that happens to be in a congregation that is offended. They are so surprised that we would try to sing it, even try to sing it in their language.
Yes.
And to maybe just incorporate some gentle movement, that they're just overwhelmed. They're grateful. The other thing is, one of the songs I use quite a bit from West Africa, Nigeria, Wa 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 E Mimi Mo. Whenever I find there's a Nigerian especially Yoruba person in the congregation, I will ask them to teach it with me, or just have them teach it. No two people teach it the same. Any more than you have five organists playing the wedge fugue are going to teach it to play it the same. I mean, we get fixed like there's a way that it's done. The other thing about it is when I teach it, and this, especially when someone's present that I'm aware of from another culture, is to turn into the student immediately. Give me some advice. How was addiction? How was the, what else, you know, could we do? That changes the whole conversation. I think we need to become students whenever possible, even if we think we know something pretty well. Just the idea that we're open to someone. We feel like we have to be so definitive and in charge that sometimes we defeat our pastoral. Now, when I say we, I'm talking about me here. Okay?
Yeah, those are good words, though.
And sometimes people expect us to be that way. But, you know, it's not weakness to listen. This maestro stuff doesn't work. I don't care what style you're in. It doesn't work in today's culture. So, and it's just not what we're about. We're about building community. So I find that to be a really helpful comment. And who else was it? You were telling me about, tell us, can you give us a little context? Stand up so they can hear you. A little context. We were talking about the young woman from, or not so young anymore, but the woman from China and her song. And
I'm trying to figure out, like, where the Chinese people's worshippers songs are going to be fit into the streams. So Chinese people now, they have their own sets of worship songs. Mm-hmm. And when I'm in their midst to worship, I'm trying to understand, because I pretty much grow up in North America, Canada, and I'm not so much in the Chinese culture, but I worship with the Chinese people. And their songs are all, like, I try to understand, put it this way. I try to understand where they're coming from, or try to analyze, is there a theological base in there, or is it a biblical base, or maybe just a song. They call it worship song, so I would try to ask.
I can't remember the name of the woman that has all the songs from mainland China that the unregistered churches sing. Can you think of her name?
Xiaoming.
Yeah. She's like the Charles Wesley of the of China or something. Hundreds of songs. And for some of the what they call unregistered churches, that's the hymnal. And they're beautiful melodies. She has a real gift for melody. But the songs in her particular witness are very particular out of her experience. I mean, if you've been through the Cultural Revolution, you can understand. If you've seen the topography of her home province, and I think it's Hunan province, you get a sense for it. And this is one of those cases where can that specific testimony work in other places? It doesn't mean it's invalid, but is it transferable? In the global song that I work with, really only a very small percentage. There's a lot of things available, but only a very small percentage can I really take and put it in your place or your church. And it depends in part on a lot of things, your faith tradition, who is in your neighborhood, who attends your church. There has to be some other, you know, reasons. A lot of songs, and even historically, you realize that some of them filter out because they just can't quite, are not accessible, except maybe for certain traditions we'll keep on, but others won't. So there's a lot of variability here. So one of your jobs is to determine what song can have life in your community and be a voice for them. But I would encourage you to err on the side of, what's the word I'm looking for, adventure. Not to say, right away, no, they couldn't work. I hear a whole lot of that. Shutting off the spirit before it gets out of the game. Whatever it is, that was a horse race. Okay, one of those metaphors. But, you know, live with it. How could you teach it? Why might it inform? But there's the other thing that's brought up.
Kit.
Kit. It's one of the things that Kit brings up. as well. It goes back to Augustine. You know, I love the melody so much, but am I focusing on the words and things like that? You know, that old kind of... And I think, we'll talk about it a little bit later, but I think there are some songs that are very attractive melodies, and I look at the theology, I'm a little nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to speak personally when we get to that part, and you don't have to agree with me, but it causes me to think. So, we've got a... This is a marriage. The text by itself spoken is not going to do it. The music by itself without the words, unless it evokes words, is not going to necessarily do it. It's a nice mood. But what really brings that text to life? But again, that is somewhat culturally situated. It's no accident that we sing different tunes than they do in the UK to the same text. You've been over to UK and they have all these texts that you know, but they have these tunes that, you know, what's wrong with these people? Why can't they sing the real music? You know? Or even from hymnal to hymnal in different traditions. So there's a quite fluid kind of situation. This is great because it calls for you to be the artist. It calls for you to be in discernment, in prayer, in creativity, and you should be planning worship in community, not as an isolated act at your computer. At least as much as possible. You've got to have an ear to the ground. Or else, if you aren't careful, you're transforming your choir, your congregation into your image. Mm-hmm. And as Christ-like as you want to be, that's not the image we're after. This is dangerous stuff, isn't it? Oh, but it's such a privilege. Such a privilege. I want to do one old thing with you before lunch. Take the other sheet that has a chart on it. Some years ago, it dawned on me that the actual musical form that a song is packaged in influences how it's absorbed by the congregation. Now, I'm going to set aside musical style for a moment and focus just on the actual structure. And I mentioned, it was really interesting how in my growing up, maybe some of you had a similar experience in your churches, we actually had a different structures for different kinds of gatherings throughout the week. Sunday morning was the classic hymn, four stanzas. Sunday evening was a lot of refrain forms, gospel songs especially. Other kinds of informal gatherings, or Wednesday nights, or Sunday school assembly, youth group, were often what I'm calling here the cyclic structures, the shorter structures. And people just intuitively did that kind of thing, it seemed. And so it occurred to me these things must have a meaning, the way it's packaged. So I started to do some work on this, largely out of ethnomusicology, and then some experience in Africa, this is what I came up with. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I hope it stirs up some conversation. The sequential structures, I'm calling sequential because these are your classic hymns where stanza one theoretically leads to stanza two, to stanza three, to stanza four, and it's wrapped up some way. So there are many sermons, poetic kind of sermons, said in very clear language. And of course, we have a wide range of hymnody that goes, you know, from Luther and Watts and Wesley all the way to current hymn writers who write beautiful things. This is crafted language. It's very wordy. I don't mean wordy in a negative sense. I'm being descriptive here. You have to read to participate in this, unless you've learned that song. It's very eye-oriented. You need some kind of display, a book or whatever, to do this. I'm not going to teach you a five-stanza hymn by ear too successfully, at least initially. Literate tradition, it has a very predictable performance time. You'll see why that's important in just a minute. But I know that if one stanza takes 35 seconds and there's five stanzas, I can pretty much tell how long this is. Now, have you ever had a pastor who said, I need a hymn on grace that's no more than 2.5 minutes long because the service has drained long? I would probably go to this tradition and, you know, to find one of those for whatever reason. Very content-oriented. you can't do anything else physically while you're singing one of these hymns. You have to really be giving yourself the text to follow the train of thought that many hymn writers have. Then one of the key aspects, I alluded to it earlier, is this kind of structure moves to a climax in the last stanza some way. There are different ways of doing it. The one I mentioned this morning, when the morning stars together, move toward a prayer at the end. Many ones do that. The final one is some kind of invocation or some kind of prayer at the end. You spot those imperative verbs. Lift every voice and sing, for example, the African-American hymn that's a gift to all of us. The last stanza is a prayer. Lead us into the light. It has a series of imperative verbs there. So watch for that. And then in your interpretation of that hymn, that should affect musically how you're going to handle that prayer. Now, I overdid it this morning perhaps, but I decided to slow it down. I don't slow down every last stanza. But in that particular case, I wanted the sense that we had shifted from a narrative of the author's sense of the history of church music to now a dedication. So it has musical import there. Many other ways to enter. For example, it's in this hymnal. Find do 465. Here's a wonderful Japanese hymn coming 13 years after the bombs were dropped in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. It's a gathering of Japanese, not just Japanese, Asian Christians in Japan for a Christian education conference. And this hymn was written in a gagaku Japanese mode to be a theme hymn for it. And so there's much more I could say about it, but right now I just want to point out its overall. It's written on John 14:6, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. So you'll notice that the last word of the first and second and third stanza is way, truth, and life. And then there are ways within the cultural context of Asia at that time, especially Japan. I could spend a half hour in this hymn, but I can't. Let me point out one. Look at stanza 3. Nature's secrets open wide, changes never cease. Where, oh, where can weary souls find the source of peace? Undo all those sore distress, torn by inner strife. Jesus, healer, bring your balm, for you are the life. The secrets of the atom bomb were nature's secrets that were open wide. And this is the gift poets have. Rather than saying the atom bomb blew things up, they say it in a way. And then what did it cause? You can imagine 13 years later, it was still quite evident what it caused if you were in those cities. So the final stanza then is a prayer. Grant, O God, imperative verb, an age renewed, filled with deathless love, help us as we work and pray, send us from above, truth and courage, faith and power needed in our strife. Jesus, Savior, be our way, be our truth, implied, be our life. So there's an example of that prayer motif. You might come back and sing that a little bit later, but right now I want to move ahead. Now, another great way to end a hymn is the eschatological reference. We had one of those in the communion hymn, Una Spiga, the Grand Fiesta. If you want a lexicon of heaven hymns at the last stanza, Chuck Wesley does it for you. That's Charles. And we're pretty close, so I think. But he has the last stanzas of his hymns are almost a lexicon of eschatology. Why? How many Methodists do we have here? Should I ask you why that Charles Wesley always gets to heaven? Can you tell me why? Well, I don't want to embarrass you because you probably would say it right, but let me just go ahead and fill it. I think one of the many reasons is one of the Wesleyan doctrines is moving toward perfection. Where does perfection take place? It takes place in heaven. And so it's natural that this journey, whatever it is going to take us to heaven quite often. Now, during Wesley's time, there were a few sectarian groups of the Wesleyan community decided they had achieved heaven on earth. They had achieved perfection on earth. But of course, you realize the problem with this. They started to boast about their perfection, and therefore, they had not achieved perfection. and there's other, but there's that sense, and it's deeper than that too, but there's that sense that we're gradually becoming, in the Imago Dei, in the image of God, we're becoming gradually sanctified in our life as we walk closer and closer to Christ. And so the ultimate consummation of that sanctification is in heaven. So it's quite natural that you'd have. It's not the only hymn. The only hymns, other hymns have that heaven motif too, but it's especially strong in the Wesleyan. Some hymns end with an ethical imperative. We should be like this. We should be like Christ. So there's classic ways to end those. Now, I love this kind of hymnody. I love this kind of hymnody, but I really feel that in most situations, not all, but in most situations in the cultural context or social location of congregations and the way we'd have that, you know, four, five stanza hymns is just a bit much. That kind of concentration it takes to deal with that kind of content only. Now, there are exceptions. You know, Anglicans will be more likely to do this. RCA may be more given to these certain reform movements are not as fond of refrains, for example, and things like it, or choruses or whatever. So there are certain cultures, but as a whole, I think if we want to have an intergenerational experience, it's pretty hard to put like that's all you sing. My perfect church, it would be just fine with me. Not really. I guess I've kind of grown fond of other structures too. But you know, I can take a high dose of this, but then I'm weird and have tenure, so I can do what I want. Now, the other side of it then is the cyclic structures, and I finally found the word in ethnomusicology that really helped me, because the other references for this growing up were diminutive of it. Chorus sounded like it was part of a song and not the whole thing. One of my favorite and most influential professors that I loved dearly when I had hymnology from him, Don Husted, who died recently in 93 or so, a tremendous fellow, he called them hymnlets. So the diminutive of it. But when I started to actually spend time in cultures where this was the primary structure, I learned a lot, that they had a different capability. And by that I'm talking about African, Taze, a variety of musical structures that use this, certain Latin American context, and of course contemporary Christian as well. So I think that a better term for this than repetition, as I experienced it, on the page it looks like repetition. But in the experience, when it's done well, in almost every one of these styles, it's theme and variation. It's theme and variation. And the key to enlivening this kind of song is how you introduce subtle variations. Okay, take this morning. We did Uyai Mose. Little by little, we got it going, the parts. We sang this one thing through, and then finally we added some movement. Then the percussion came in. Then I started singing over the top. Then we started clapping. No two cycles were the same. I didn't make an announcement. But the experience of it was we didn't just sing it five times. It may have looked like that on a page if you had it, but we actually developed it. And it's very natural for a lot of African songs to heat up by gradually involving the whole body as such. So if I'm in doing Taze's song, it's a different kind of variation. Often start off in unison, try to encourage parts, maybe bring in the oboe here. Relax the oboe, maybe a cantor will take a certain section, maybe bring in a violin. You know, maybe after we've sung it about 35 times, I might let everyone play it once, but no two cycles are the same. So I love this. Now, there's some really other aspects of it that is great. It's very intergenerational. Even if you can't read music because you're blind, you're too old or too young, you can participate in these structures, these cyclic structures. Also, they're great in that they can accompany ritual activity. Something else can be going on and you can watch it because it's basically memorized. That's hard to do on the sequential. I remember back in the 1970s when I was first experimenting with dance and worship in a Baptist church. Sometimes we would dance the hymns as people were singing them, and I realized what a futile thing that was. I mean, could they watch a dance or could they sing? It was not so easy. Of course, some people were afraid to watch a dance, so they just soon looked down. But that wouldn't be the approach I would take now. It's just, you know, to sing a five stanza hymn and have the dance going up. The dancers felt a little slighted. The another thing about this is it's variable in time. It can go as long as it needs to go to accompany the ritual activity, say a procession. Or some of you would have the gospel processional. Or any other kinds of communion itself. Have you ever been in a situation where you had three communion hymns listed and you actually finished after two of them, but everyone felt compelled to stay and sing the third one because it was in the bulletin? Well, with all due respect to that hymn, it's better, I think, if the music supports the ritual activity and you can bring it to a close. Or, you've never had this happen to you. You've come to the end of the service and it's obviously running past a little bit and the Baptists have already beat you to the restaurant and so you sing, you know, stanzas one and two. Mm-hmm. Well, the trouble is, if you know the sequential structure of a hymn, mm-hmm. it's kind of like stopping mid-sentence. Mm-hmm. I would much rather, if you're short running on time, find a cyclic song to close on that you can feel completion with, that you need to sing it for a couple minutes. So these forms mix back and together. One of the things that I think anytime you sing in liturgy, you're building community. Anytime you sing. I think the primary purpose on the left side is to build community in the sense of a common content that's fairly well developed theologically. But on the right side, I think the overt community building is very palpable. Again, this morning, it was quite interesting. This guy walks in off the street, but you moved together. You sang a strange language together. And at least some of you moved, and then some clapped. Some, you know, I take two out of three, clapping, singing, moving, strange language. I'll take a couple of those. It's asking a lot for a lot of us to do more than one. To a couple of those, but there was a sense of community. The little clapping that took place, it was not a clapping. I think it was clapping because there was a sense of community. It wasn't a clapping for a performance. One of the things these cyclic structures do, especially if they're heated up well, if they're theme and variation, they really have a sense of building community quickly. It happens in the others, but you know, I need to sing some of these great hymns four or five times before I can really start to feel the unity of them, because they're so deep in their message. Now, some of the hymns that you know in your congregation, growing up as a Baptist, you know, the one thing that separated us from the Methodists is that we knew all the stanzas of 10 Fanny Crosby hymns. The Methodists only knew the first stanza. We knew all the stanzas to Blessed Be the Tie. The Methodists really only knew the first stanza. All the stanzas, and then some additional ones to Amazing Grace. Methodists did pretty well in that. But, by the way, I try to be an equal opportunity offender before I'm finished. So if I haven't offended your group yet, I'll work on that. But it was an example of Baptist piety. There were certain things that were important. And so those songs, even though they were kind of on the left side, or maybe refrain forms, were so memorized they in essence became cyclical. So that can happen. There can be a process. You probably have some of those in your tradition. They're so well known people can sing all the stanzas. The ones in the middle are great because you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have the refrain the cyclical part, but you can also develop a sequence of ideas in the stanza. Two things, and we'll, two examples, and we'll stop. On the left side of that, in between sequential and refrain form, I would put a hymn like "Lift High the Cross." It has that initial refrain, and it has a series of stanzas that explain what that is. On the right side, in between refrain and cyclic structures, I would put a hymn like maybe a gospel song hymn, where basically the refrain is like the center of the hymn and the stanzas are like spokes. They basically say the same thing, just four different ways. That's fine, four different ways. And so it's not so bad to say in a gospel song we're going to sing 1, 2, and 4. It's a problem on a sequential hymn to say we're going to sing 1, 2, and 4. Because usually 3 is where there's a counter theme offered that's resolved in 4. So you see how the structure itself determines how people take this in. Final idea. You're very patient. You can imbue your liturgies, your services, in whatever style, I mean that in a broad worship style sense, with a sense of variety just by making sure that you vary the structures that happen. You can keep your theme the same, but you have a choice. Well, we probably better do a cyclical song and that mix it in. Or we need a refrain form. We got too many of these. Or I really should have one substantial hymn that outlines in detail the theology. I've got only refrain, or I've got only cyclical. And that just that subtle change without ever announcing it adds an undergirding variety to the worship that I think is very helpful. You've been very good. I'm having just more fun than I deserve. Is it okay for me to offer a blessing, or is it? Okay, let us rise. Hallelujah. Blessings flow, praise to God, all creatures here below, praise to God above ye heavenly hosts, hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.